You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast. 20 minutes with Maurice Broaddus. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robison.
And I'm Brian Stevenson, filling in for Brian Humphrey.
And you've tuned in to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast, 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is an opportunity for us to spend some time chatting with the amazing authors and creators that come on the show and see if we can't get elbow deep in the nougaty center that is their creative genius and just kind of dig in and see what's going on.
Ooh, nougaty goodness. Nougaty. I like that.
Yeah, I know.
That's I've nougat awesome. On my mind, yeah. Ryan, thank you so much, man. Brian so wishes he could be here, but he and I are both very grateful for you stepping in. We appreciate it.
Hey, not a problem.
Awesome. So, Ryan, let me introduce you to our guest host for this episode of 20 Minutes With. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Our guest host is an exotic dancer, trained in several forms of martial arts, often referred to as the Ghetto Ninja, and was voted the Indianapolis Dalai Lama. He's an award-winning haberdasher and coined the word acerbic. He graduated college at age 14 and high school at age 16. We're not quite sure how he pulled that off. Not only is he credited with inventing the question mark, he unsuccessfully tried to launch a new number between 7 and 8. When not editing or writing, he is a champion curler and often impersonates Jack Bauer, but only in a French accent. Or should I say, in a French accent. He raises free-range jackalopes with his wife and two sons when they are not solving murder mysteries. And that, my dear friend Ryan, is from his Amazon profile.
Yeah, wow.
Jeez. Yeah, Yeah. Now, check this. Normally, I'd be willing to let this go and we'll just roll with it. But as it turns out, his real life is just as fascinating as that delicious smorgasbord of balderdash I just rolled out. You see, our guest host has been writing for as long as he could hold a crayon. In second grade, his teacher had no idea what to do with him, and eventually she just put his desk in a corner, gave him a stack of paper, and told him to create. Now, his love of spec fic was fostered by a Sunday school teacher who was a closet science fiction fantasy horror fan who, between parables, turned our guest host onto comics, Doctor Who, and science fiction. Now, it took him 6 years to finish college because he was taking covert creative writing classes because his mom wanted him to pursue a more practical career. So it took him 6 years, which pretty much makes college the most expensive writing workshop our guest host has ever attended. Now, his stories have appeared in the Dark Dreams anthologies and Harlan County Horrors, as well as Apex Magazine, Black Static, and Weird Tales. He's also written two novellas, Orgy of Souls with Wrath James White, and The Devil's Marionette. Now, one of the works he's most known for is The Knights of Benton Court. This is a trilogy comprised of Kingmaker, King's Justice, and King's War. And Ryan, this is badass because this was inspired by his work with a homeless teen ministry called Outreach Inc., a real organization. Mm-hmm. After talking to many of the kids, he discovered that they didn't think of themselves as having a future. They couldn't conceptualize survival further out than a week. So he NaNoWriMos a story, almost as a lark with some of these kids, imagining them as knights and princesses of the streets. And that became the Knights of Benton Court.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Awesome. Yeah. He also has a convention named after him, sort of. MoCon, which is hosted by the Indiana Horror Writers Association, began just as some great discussions among spec fic authors about issues of faith, gender, and race in fiction. It has since evolved into an annual gathering of epic proportions, sometimes billed as the intersection of spirituality, art, and social justice. And interestingly, just one more thing here. MoCon spawned the Dark Faith Anthology, which is one of his more recent works. This is a collection of horror tales that step beyond salvation and damnation with 30 stories and poems that reveal the darkness beneath belief. Note the quotes there. The anthology earned multiple major award nominations, including the Stoker Award, a Nebula Award for the short story Ghosts of New York by Jennifer Poland, and had four stories included in four separate Year's Best reprints. And the recently released follow-up, Dark Faith Invocations, promises to be equally astonishing. He is also one of the contributing authors for Eighth Day Genesis, a world-building codex, a text that seeks to help writers, game masters, and all creative people build their worlds, alongside such notables as Matthew Wayne Selznick, Tim Wagoner, Janine Spendlove, and others. And lastly, he invites us to buy his books because, and I quote, "I speak of the pompatus of love." Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Skype line and the big chair at the round table, Mr. Maurice Broaddus. Maurice, holy crap, with all that going on, man, I can only say thank you so much for making the time to join us today.
Wow, that was like the most impressive introduction of like all time.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Thank you. I aspire to make sure that I represent accurately and faithfully.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the actual title is Knights of Breton Court, but other than
Okay. All right. Breton Court.
Yep. Other than that, it was spot on.
Sweet.
So man, now I didn't say a word there, and I'm dabbing sweat off my brow.
Everybody's feeling the sweat. Okay, awesome. Everybody catch a breath. All right, take a drink of whatever you're drinking, because we're going to roll into 20 minutes with Maurice Broaddus. I'm just going to set the timer here so I make sure we get this thing fair and square. We, of course, completely ignore the timer, but hey, it's good to have
goals. It's nice to look at.
That's right, it is. It's a very pretty thing. Maurice, I'm going to lead off here. And in an interview, you were quoted as saying, though I must admit that after my piece was published, I started putting myself in odder and odder situations in order to have something happen to me that I could turn into another story. And that particular slice of quotage really intrigued me, and I was wondering, what did you mean by that? And is that where you get your ideas, by going out and doing weird stuff?
Well, I basically realized that if you just lead an interesting life, you will be inspired by all sorts of things just go on, because stuff will just happen to you, and stuff which just begs to be written about, including some of the people that fall into your life. There are some of my friends who just demand to be characters at all times. So who am I to stand in their way?
Absolutely. So do you find that you draw very heavily on your own life and your life experiences and weave them into stories?
Yeah. I've often referred to writing as like my very cheap form of therapy. So I basically suck in a bunch of people, and you guys have to, you guys are just stuck in on my therapy sessions with each story.
That's awesome.
I'm intrigued in how that works. I mean, I understand totally what you're talking about, and I'd like to hear a bit more about how you play that out. I mean, to take something that's real life, to take a real event, real people, and translate it into a story, you could say that's easy, but we all know it's quite a challenge. I'd like to hear more about how you approach that.
Yeah. Well, first off, I warn everyone I come in contact with that, their lives are free-for-alls for me to write about. So that's like the standard warning. It's like, hey, any story that connects to mine is, I'm perfectly, free to write from.
Do you have a release form that you hand out every time you meet somebody?
I have a t-shirt that serves as my release form. It just warns them in advance.
Awesome.
But from the introduction, when you were talking about what led up to the Knights of Breton Court, I mean, I was doing volunteer work at a homeless teen ministry. And next thing I know, I'm spinning a story out of, the character, the not really characters, but some of the teens' lives who I came in contact with, some of the scenarios we found ourselves in, because like one of the things that we would do as part of the ministry was there's this thing called street time. So we would go basically in teams of three, and we would just hit the streets, and we would go and try and find different squats where the homeless teens are staying for the night. And in Indianapolis, we have a series of bridges that span like the White River and stuff. And some of the teens were using underneath the bridge as basically their own little apartments.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But there is nothing more scary than, because we go out at night and, you come underneath this bridge and you look up and there's this hole that, someone has probably crawled up into and they might be staying in. But that moment before you stick your head into that dark hole, not knowing what's on the other side, that begs to be a story point.
Sure.
Because it's just a sheer moment of terror. even though nothing has ever happened to any outreach worker, but just as a human being, I'm sticking my head into darkness.
Right.
And I don't know what's on the other side. And in my story, on the other side might be a troll.
So, yeah, really. there's some real danger there.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, and I like how you're talking about taking something that, you know, again, we could take that very literally and say that someone that you meet, I don't know, like an incredibly handsome and nice sounding Canadian guy on a podcast that you're recording right now,
sure,
you just take that guy and snake him out and start, you know, putting his pieces into a story. But to take that concept of the events and the people that you're involved with and then parlaying that into the fantasy or the speculative fiction genre, that's fantastic that you have that opportunity to do that. In addition to that strength of storytelling and characterization and the long list of things that we've heard you do as far as accolades go, you know, spirituality and thematic work really seems to play a lot into who you are and what you do. Where does theme and that kind of structure of theme really start to play in for you as a writer as you're creating these stories based on real events or real people?
Theme depends on... you know, it's kind of weird to say. Themes for me depend on what I'm internally wrestling with at the time. Mm-hmm. For example, like with a story, like with Orgy of Souls I did with Wrath James White, I was, you know, really wrestling with what does a saving faith look like? I mean, any religion claims to have a saving faith or a faith that can lead you into eternal reward, but practically speaking, what does that look like in a person's life? Because mm-hmm. A lot of people can claim faith, but you know, how do they actually live it out? And that was a question I was wrestling with in my own life. And for, like I said, this is, writing becomes my therapy session. So if I'm wrestling with it, hey, guess what? My main character, bam, he's now wrestling with this issue. So now what does that look like as he wrestles with this? And then he puts himself into various situations where he's trying to figure out, well, what does faith look like? And that became the theme, one of the themes in Orgy of Souls, you know, before mm-hmm. we get to all the, you know, demons and sacrifice and blood right. orgy. So, you know.
Spec fix stuff, right.
Right, exactly. Maurice, and for the record, yeah. If my wife listens to this, I have not personally used any orgies. strictly, awesome. In fact, that's the best part of having a co-writer. That was all Wrath's fault.
That was all Wrath. Yes, yeah. Wrath. He's the orgy man. Okay, good.
Yeah. You want orgies? See Wrath.
We're going to have to get him on the show, definitely. Awesome.
Absolutely.
So, Maurice, do you find that you have a theme when you sit down to write a story or a novel, whatever the project is at hand? Do you find more often than not that you have a theme before you start the story, or does that evolve as you write the story?
It's a little bit of both. A lot of the times, I have an idea that I want to work through before I sit down. I have a middle grade detective novel that I'm about ready to start working on, actually next week. And that sprang out of, I was a substitute teacher for a while. And so, you know, I would encounter all these kids who, and I made a point of volunteering for the hardest classes and the most troubled kids and everything.
Looking for story material.
And, you know, that's always in the back of my mind.
Right, right.
But I do have a heart for you know, those kids and just sure, the idea sure. of, you know, what causes that hole, basically, in some of these kids' lives. Which is something, was just a notion I wanted to explore in a story.
Okay.
And so that's where, you know, so that's one of the things I'm working on with that story. But then there's some stories like, basically I have two projects planned that I'm going to be working on for fall through the winter. And the second project's a steampunk story. And that has no theme other than I wanted to just let my hair down, so to speak.
Yeah, man.
Right, right. And then just write and just have fun in the steampunk universe that I've created. And just have at it and see what happens.
Okay. And Maurice, I'm looking at your profile pic, so I'm assuming letting your hair down is a metaphorical context, right?
It has been metaphorical for about 10, 15 years.
Awesome.
That's really cool, too, that you talked about that. I think that's something that a lot of writers should really think about is the fact that, you know, while theme is obviously a important part of writing, sometimes it's just got to be about fun, man, you know, like just have a good time in a world that you've created and let that happen.
And then as far as that goes, you know, once I finish that first draft of the story, you know, when I go back and start doing the second draft, I might find a theme that I didn't even realize I was exploring.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people can claim that experience. That's great.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Maurice Broaddus after this brief promotional break.
Do you like movies? Well, let me make you an offer that you can't refuse. Have you ever found yourself standing at the local Cineplex with that smell of freshly buttered popcorn wafting through your nostrils, wondering if that new Hugh Jackman movie is really worth your time? Or have you ever lamented about that time you spent scouring the vast expanse of the internet for movie and DVD release dates when, let's be honest, you'd rather be leveling up your Troll Hunter, working on the great American novel, or even watching kitten videos? Oh yes, I said kitten videos. I will do the work for you. All I ask is 15 to 30 minutes of your time every Tuesday. My name is Michael Faulkner, and every Tuesday is showtime at the weekly Podioplex, your audio guide to what's new at the box office, how the top 10 fared over the weekend, and what's coming to your home theater on DVD and Blu-ray. You can find the weekly Podioplex on the Chronic Rift Network at www.chronicrift.com, along with a plethora of other podcasts that explore the culture in pop culture. The weekly Podioplex, brought to you by the Chronic Rift. Thanks for listening. We'll see you at the theater.
That's a wrap!
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Maurice Broaddus.
Just out of total curiosity, too, because it seems like you pretty much wake up at like 12:01 in the morning and do something until about 11:59, and then get 2 minutes of sleep and then wake up, rinse, repeat.
That's so close to the truth.
How long does a draft take for you, just out of total curiosity?
For a novel, about 6 months, depending on depending on deadlines, honestly.
Sure.
I tend to become much more disciplined as the actual deadline looms.
Awesome how they do that, eh?
Right.
So if you could take that experience and that skill set that you've developed as an author today and sort of, you know, time travel back X number of years and there's younger you wrestling away at the first pieces you've ever done, is there any kind of pieces of advice about how to write that you would give to younger Maurice to help him really just get in there and charge ahead?
You know what? Actually, I think younger Maurice did okay, because younger Maurice was pretty free to just write and be willing to fail. And I think that was probably my key. It took me 7 years to write my first novel.
Wow.
And that was strictly me just exploring, you know, what does it mean to write a novel? How do you write a novel? You know, how do you end a novel?
Were you trying to write a novel, or was this just an exploration of creativity?
No, I was trying to write a novel.
Okay.
I think I made the first time novelist big mistake, which is I tried to write a novel that was very personal to me. It's like that great American novel, great American story I always wanted to tell.
Sure.
But I did not have the skill set to do it properly.
Right.
And it was a skill set that, you know, I'm still honing and still working on and everything. Yeah. And I'm actually going back and revisiting that, you know.
Oh, sure. Well, we recently had a very cool interview with Shannon McGuire, and she talked about there's a novel that she wants to write right now, but she doesn't have the skill. She knows she doesn't have the skill to write it. So she's planning out the three novels that she needs to write to get the skills she needs to write this fourth novel that she really wants to write.
Right.
Just amazing. It sounds like that's what you were going through as well, just those first million words.
Exactly. And for me, the experimenting along the way came in the form of writing short stories. That way I could get that experience of beginning, middle, and ending of a project, you know, so that along the way, you know, to keep – it's almost like, – because 7 years is a long journey.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
And so you need something to hope – some bits of hope to hold on to along the way. And so for me, that came in the form of short stories, because to this day, I still haven't got my first novel published.
Okay.
Yeah, so when Kingmaker was my first novel-length work published, but it was also the fourth novel that I'd written, maybe fourth or fifth novel that I'd written by that point.
Wow. And the other novels?
Let's see. The first one is one that my first novel was actually a really good novel. So I think it would only take a polish for me to actually put it out there.
Okay.
The second novel was an urban fantasy novel that, some bits that were salvageable, and they actually made it into Kingmaker.
Okay.
And the rest of it, there's about a novella or so worth that's left that I don't know what to do with yet. But, you know, I know they're there, and that's words that I can come back and shape at some point.
Sure.
The third novel, right, now it's Just Us, right?
Yes, Just Us. We'll turn off the record button. Go ahead.
Okay. So I got it in my head that I wanted to try and write an African-American romance novel.
Okay.
And so my third novel was an African-American romance novel. And I don't know what I was thinking at the time, but like that novel will never see the light of day.
Oh, I mean, really?
Never, no, ever will that novel see the light of day.
Now, how can that be? I mean, that doesn't sound like such a radical out there concept, really. I mean, what's holding you back from that?
Well, okay. A, I wrote it under a pen name.
Okay.
Marquis Styles.
Ooh. Nice. Dude, I like that.
Well, that was my, I think in another life, I wanted to be a pimp, and that would
have been. Jeez.
And so that was problem number one. And the bigger problem was I made the mistake of telling this to Rath James White.
Uh-oh.
That I'd done this.
And, which tainted it forever for you, didn't it?
Absolutely. End of grief about this. In fact, whenever we get into an argument, he just breaks out, okay, Marquis.
Let's trot out that romance novel, shall we? Hmm?
Right. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay.
And then the novel I wrote after that was a sword and soul novel. It was a barbarian tale set in ancient Africa, and actually, that one's a good, really good novel too. So that might actually see the light of day next year. As a matter of fact, I have a publisher who's actually interested in it. So,
okay.
So that might actually see the light of day next year.
There's stuff in the trunk from Maurice Broaddus that may roll out.
Exactly.
Excellent. Well, and let me ask you, Maurice. Now you're a member of the Indiana Horror Writers Association, and the bulk of your work has largely been aligned to the horror vibe.
Yeah.
But I heard you just fess up that now you're exploring steampunk. Mm-hmm. And perhaps other branches of the spec fic tree.
Yes.
Now, you had mentioned just for fun, is the scope of your stories, the stories that you want to tell, is that expanding? And what the heck happened to writers just sticking with one genre, for crying out loud?
You know, that's an interesting question. I have been telling people that, you know, after years of therapy, I have no demons left to write about, so I have to.
Yeah. Does anybody really buy that?
No one really buys
okay,
that.
Okay, good.
Especially Raph, because I actually have another book up with Raph, so and it's going to be a post-apocalyptic novel, so it's like, well, that went out the window.
See, there we go. Another genre. Holy crap.
Right. Yeah, I can't get away from it. I can't quit horror. It's what I do.
Okay.
But I think what it is, I think you're right. It's just the scope of the stories I want to tell. It's just I actually don't read a lot of horror in my spare time, for example.
That's interesting. How come?
The genre I read for fun is actually crime fiction.
Okay.
So, you know, you give me Elmore Leonard or George Pelicanos, and I just go to my happy place.
Gotcha.
And you can actually see their influences in, like, my Knights of Breton Court series. Because in a lot of ways, that's just an homage to you know, stories, those kind of storytellers. I just threw in, you know, the occasional dragon or zombie or, you know, whatever. Sure.
Absolutely. A little noir dragon action there.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And so I just really love stories. And so whatever story just captivates me at the time, or whatever story I want to challenge myself with at the time, you know, that's where I gravitate to. The steampunk thing was strictly about challenging myself, for example.
Okay.
That's cool that you're taking that approach too. I like that. I want to dwell a bit on this concept of genre. Specifically on your website, you have a list of things that you've learned doing a convention scene for the time that you've been doing it. I mean, mm-hmm. you've got your own convention, so obviously you are the Yoda of this. So one of the points that you have on that list, you've got it in a nice red font, so it merits being mentioned, which is you said, I can say I write urban fantasy and I have it mean exactly what I think it should mean. And in my experience, I've always had trouble defining urban fantasy, so I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts are on that statement. What inspired you to make that statement?
Right. Well, I mean, I didn't know what to classify Knights of Breton Court. It mm-hmm. was a story I wrote, and I believe in writing the story first and then figuring out how to market it later.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And so, you know, as I was submitting it, people were, you know, especially with Kingmaker, I mean, I thought it might have been just an expanded horror story. It was pretty dark and pretty grim. And everybody's like, no, it's an urban fantasy story. So I'm like, oh, urban
dark urban fantasy.
Right, exactly. So urban fantasy meant something, one thing in my head, but from what I was gathering, like, oh no, it's urban fantasy, meaning that, you know, it's it's something fantastical that takes place in a modern day city type environment, and where the city is as much a character as anything else. So I'm like, Well, yeah, that's true about my story. It is an urban fantasy, and the city of Indianapolis is as much a character in my series as any of the other. Actually, I think it looms largest as the largest character in the series, frankly.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. So in that regard, yeah, it's an urban fantasy story. But for me, when I hear urban fantasy, and when I'm writing, my brand of urban fantasy, I mean, I'm writing about black characters in the city, and it's truly an urban fantasy. I mean, that's almost the way I'd have to put it, because a lot of times when I see urban, for all these urban fantasy tales, rarely do you see a person of color in them.
Sure, right? Sure.
What cities are you guys living in where you don't find any people of color in the stories you're in?
Sure, you had mentioned the whitewashing in Jim Butcher's books.
Mm. Yeah, so. and I'm a fan of his. The stories, but yeah, I mean, if I've been to those cities.
and there are people of color there. Yeah. Sure. Well, and that actually raises. I'm intrigued by the discussions that you've had at MoCon, and having discovered this, I'm intrigued to want to attend and be a part of these discussions where you're dealing with race, you're dealing with gender, you're dealing with some of these issues, and spec fic in particular seems rife with those the stereotypes, the tropes, the cliches, and a place where those issues are coming out. What can you give us just a quick glimpse of some of the, maybe not the resolutions, but some of the discoveries perhaps that you made at like this past year's MoCon regarding some of those topics in spec fic?
Right. One of the keys that we found in doing MoCon is we make it a point not to draw any resolutions.
Okay.
We're all about continuing the conversation, because if you draw a resolution, it's like, oh, well, we solved that problem. Let's move on to another one.
And you draw a line rather than continuing the discussion.
Gotcha. Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So I'm particularly proud of the last two MoCons, frankly, because the MoCon two MoCons ago, we did homosexuality, the church and genre.
Oh, wow.
And now, don't get me wrong. That was probably the MoCon I was most nervous about.
Sure.
Because
highly charged issues.
Highly charged issue. We hold it in a church, and I'm in Bible Belt country. Right. I had invited pastors in to hear the discussion, and then I invited, I invited a lot of my gay writers and gay artists, and I said, "All right, we're going to have this conversation, and we're going to be frank, we're going to be honest, it's going to be raw, and we're just going to have at it." Except I set it up so that it wasn't. I didn't want to do any sort of we're not going to debate, because I think debating people's sexual orientation is, well, stupid.
And fraught with all kinds of trouble. Yeah.
Right, right. But what I was interested in is what is each of your stories? You know, what has been your experience in the church? What has been your experience in genre? Tell us that story and how has that affected you? And how has that affected your relationships? And how has that affected your career? Let's have that discussion. So everybody just shared their stories. That conversation, I think I let that panel go, and we must have gone like 2 hours on that.
Wow.
And I could have easily gone a lot longer.
What was the upshot of it?
The upshot of it, honestly, was, you know what? I need to I had a lot of Christians come up to me and say, you know, I think we need to rethink this whole issue.
This, excellent.
From top to bottom. We just need to rethink how we do it. We need to rethink the message that the church is sending out. Let's just rethink this, because I'm a Christian, for example,
right?
And if at the core of my religion it says, you know, love one another, if I haven't done a good job of loving whoever, then the rest of my message and the rest of my words are good for nothing.
There you go.
And so that was the one thing I wanted to hammer home most, is just, if I haven't loved you well, anything else I got to say is crap.
Now, how has that affected? How has that impacted your writing? Or has it?
It absolutely. Well, I mean, frankly, it's been. I guess it kind of goes from the other upshot, which is, you know, considering the church background I started off in, which was a very, very fundamentalist background, it actually took genre to make me revisit my own theology. It was going to conventions and meeting you know, people of different orientations and everything to go, you know what? I've really come at this all wrong. You know, it's easy to have a dogmatic stance when there's no face attached, but now these are people I care about.
Right.
So I need to rethink a lot of positions that I thought I held, but that are, you know, essentially garbage now.
Holy crap, Maurice. I think you just came up with the best argument in the world for spec fic and genre fiction. That's freaking awesome. Oh, man. Put that on a t-shirt and let's go. Let's march. Right. Damn.
Well, and then this year's MoCon, the social issue we explored this last time was about people of color in genre. And it was a conversation we had once before. I think it was our very second. I think at MoCon 2 we had a similar conversation. So this is almost like a, you know, let's like I said, we don't want to end the conversation. Let's revisit that. So we revisited that conversation with different players and everything. And we again we I wanted everybody to share their stories. What was it like coming up in genre when you know? Because we are, because frankly, we're in essentially the first and second wave of genre writers of color.
Right.
So we are, you know, it's sad that it's kind of, you know, dating us, but, you know, the fact of the matter is we're actually here. We're on the forefront of it. You know, so it's like with me and with Rath and writers like Chesha Burke and Tanana Reeve Du, Brandon Massey. I mean, we're like first and second wave of people of color writing horror. So,
sure.
So what's it like, you know, coming up when it's just you essentially at these conventions.
Right. And what is that like? I mean, how does that impact your perspective of your role as a writer, as a genre writer and as a genre writer of color?
Well, I mean, one of the things is, you know, I'm always about challenging the status quo. It's like challenge, you know, I have my stories that I have to tell. My story in Weird Tales, for example, that Weird Tales was one of the crown jewels. When I first started mapping out my career, I was like, Weird Tales is one of the places I want to be published in.
There you go.
And I had three that I had picked. I had Weird Tales, Cemetery Dance, and a magazine of science fiction and fantasy. So those are my big three that I wanted to get in. I've actually made two out of three. So
shooting for the trifecta.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Awesome.
You know, when I'm writing my stories, you know, my story in Weird Tales, my family, my mother's family is from Jamaica, for example.
Right.
And so my story in Weird Tales was a story about a guy who's going back to revisit his roots in Jamaica because these are my stories. And this is my perspective that I'm coming from. And these are stories that I don't see when I casually open a Cemetery Dance or Weird Tales or most genre magazines. These weren't stories I saw coming up, but sure. I'm here now. So I can tell these stories.
Excellent. Excellent. And, mm-hmm. and dude, I hope you continue to do so for a very long time. Guys, I hate to do this because we're already just building up a head of steam, but the clock basically kicked my ashtray over and stormed out of the door and has left the room. We are so out of time. But Maurice, this has been awesome. This has been enlightening and helpful and incredibly inspiring. So thank you for making the time and joining us today.
Absolutely. Right,
you're quite welcome.
Excellent. Welcome. Excellent. Ryan, closing thoughts or I mean, what was that as awesome for you as it was for me?
How do you have closing thoughts when we've covered like 5% of the things this guy's
I know, done? I know. we try and tie it off somehow into a nice, neat little bow, but you're right. How did we do that?
No unanswered prayers on this one. I have more questions, but hey, I'll hold on to those for now, and maybe we'll revisit this in the near future.
There you go. We can have Maurice back sometime for another 20 minutes.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
Sweet. Awesome. All right. Well, dear friends, thank you for hitting that play button as always and tuning into the Roundtable Podcast. We so deeply appreciate that. I do hope you had as much fun as we did on this one. And if you did, do consider a trip out to iTunes to give us a rating or a review. That's always welcome. If you have comments or want to continue this conversation, the comment section on the post has been a vital and vibrant place for key ideas and then continuing that discussion. Please feel free to do so. You can drop us a line at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. And generally just, wow. Now look, don't fret. in just a couple of days, we're going to have Maurice back. And we're going to take all this creative awesomeness and we're going to apply it to workshopping a story idea. So, you know, if this was badass, just wait a couple of days. until then, Ryan, any suggestions as to something our audience might be doing during the next few days?
Drink lots of water, get lots of rest, and get ready for this bad boy because it's going to be hot.
I'm just liking that. Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And friends, remember, you find what you're looking for. I promise you that. So go look for awesome stuff. Look for the Blue Label top shelf goodness. And baby, it will drop in your lap. I guarantee it. Until that couple of days goes by, you guys take care. Be frosty. We will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is at writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.